history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are stories there that really ought to be told. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their memories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. You know, there's really no limit to what we can learn. So yes, we're educated. We're also entertained. And so often we leave inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. As our country and our world continue to be gripped by this coronavirus pandemic, this is a week with two major holidays marking miraculous comebacks to overcome what looked like certain defeat. And I know we're all hoping and praying that that's exactly what we're going to see here in 2020. And as we gather physically or digitally for those holidays of Passover and Easter this week, let's remember our men and women in uniform who are marking those moments all over the world. 75 years ago, there were Americans giving their lives for our freedom on those holidays. And I thought we'd start by hearing how those holidays were marked in the European and Pacific theaters in the final year of World War II. More than 550,000 Jewish Americans served in our armed forces during World War II, and one of them gave me a call this week from Las Vegas. Selwyn Dante wanted to update me on his story with the fact that he was recently honored by the French government with their highest award. He can now wear a medal signifying that he is a Chevalier in the Legion of Honor, a reflection of France's gratitude for his role in its liberation 75 years ago. His service with the 638th Tank Destroyer Battalion in Europe would include the chance to visit a liberated concentration camp and witness some of the inhumane treatment that Jews and other prisoners of the Nazis had faced. Before that experience, though, this 18-year-old from Louisiana had a chance to mark Passover in a wartime setting.
I attended the first Pesach service in Europe. We did it in Belgium. All the troops, anywhere in that vicinity. 1st, 3rd, 9th Army, and British 2nd Army had several hundred of us, Jewish people, to attend that Seder service in Belgium.
Is Passover something that you had celebrated back home?
Always.
Every year?
Every year.
So your whole life, Passover is a significant thing?
Absolutely.
You fast, you read the story of Moses and the Israelites in Egypt.
Oh, yeah.
It's a big deal. But that Passover, 1945, with 1,000 other soldiers who were fighting this war against an enemy that wants to exterminate the Jews. What
was
that like?
That had great significance because that was the first Passover that they had had in, I guess, 5 or 6 years before anybody had Passover.
The significance of the words you read and the ceremonies that you carry out, did it take on greater meaning there?
Well, my grandfather was a part-time rabbi. He took on the religious responsibilities of all of Southeast Arkansas. Mm. They didn't have a rabbi, so he was an acting rabbi. But I've been from a religious family for all my life.
And I'm sure that you'd always been able to imagine what Moses and all of these Israelites in captivity in Egypt,
yes,
were thinking when the original Passover happened. But to be there in a war zone, knowing that your life is at stake and all these 1,000 Jewish soldiers with you, their lives are at stake. What went through your mind as you participated in these same things you'd done your whole life in a very different setting?
I've gotten to that point where I wasn't scared. Just accepted things of what they were. I was so happy to be able to celebrate Passover. It's a very important holiday. I'm a strong believer in the Jewish faith. It's never going to be eliminated completely. It's not possible. Don't care what they say. They can all hem and haw about it. But you cannot kill all the Jews on earth. Even though we're a small minority of the billions of people here we have, you're just not going to be able to get rid of us. I don't think the Lord will let it.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. If in that moment, as not even a 19-year-old yet, you're still 18 years old, celebrating Passover, knowing that those people thousands of years ago were spared, is there a real belief?
That never entered my mind at all then. I'm more interested in seeing about the war ending and us getting rid of those damn Nazis. I didn't even think about that at all. I know it'd be a lot to consider that way, but it never entered my mind to think about that. All I want to do is complete the job of getting rid of the Nazis.
And he would help complete that job. That was Selwyn Dante. And right after he marked Passover in Europe 75 years ago, millions of servicemen and women observed the Easter holiday. In the Pacific, another teenager named George Chrisman was about to experience his first taste of combat at the Battle of Okinawa with Navy Beach Party Team 62.
Easter Sunday, we climbed out of the cargo ship, lounged the cargo nets, loaded ourselves onto the Amtraks because they weren't sure what the beach was. We get into the beach with the ship. So we went on the Amtraks. We gathered out. It was still dark. Gathered around a big circle. We had Easter sunrise service there with the chaplain. And after the chaplain had the Easter sunrise service, we left for the beach. And about that time, my commander, the beach master, had his radio, and all the big ships started shelling the beach where we were going to land to clear it further. And then as soon as we got near the beach, stopped that shelling, and the Amtrak continued on. The Army went ashore. About the third wave, we went ashore, dug our foxholes, set up the radio communications and beach markers, and started unloading ships. Very scary.
I would imagine so, and a pretty important role in that invasion. But you said the first thing you guys did was you had an Easter sunrise service. The
right.
Chaplain led the way with that. Do you remember anything about what was said there or what that meant to you to start that day that way?
Nope. Just scary.
Yeah. I imagine you felt like you were going to need some extra protection.
Oh, yes. Very much so.
And so you talk about the beachmaster and this landing party. So basically your guy's job was to get there first and set up some kind of organization so all these waves and waves and waves of troops coming ashore would be organized and going in the right direction.
Right.
Is that right?
The beachmaster's job is to direct that landing.
Uh-huh. It sounds like a pretty dangerous job, too, though.
Well, yes, it is.
Did you guys come under enemy fire?
Yes. We had a lot of Japanese up there in the mountains that were shooting at us.
Uh-huh. So what did you do?
Duck.
You had a foxhole and you...
Yeah, but the foxhole was only about a foot deep.
That doesn't do much good.
Because you had hard pan.
Uh-huh.
So you dug whatever you could and you lay down in there, and then it rained and we got full of water and... Didn't worry about the water, just get down in there.
So what goes through your mind when you're in that foxhole and you still hear these rounds going off around you?
Hope you live for the next day. And when that first day, we looked up there and it was a little house about, 50 yards or 100 yards away. They were flying the Japanese flag.
Mm-hmm.
So about three of us went up there, and first we called in for an American flag to be sent in. They sent the flag in. When we got the flag, we went over took the flagpole down. It's one of those flagpoles where you pull a pin out and the whole pole comes down.
Mm-hmm.
And we took the flag down. We put the American flag up and put the flag back, pole back up. And that little house that was there, we didn't know it at the time, but there was a guy up on the roof was shooting at people. So eventually, after we had the American flag up, we went up there with a couple of hand grenades and blew up the whole building. And he was down on the ground, dead. No,
but you didn't know he was there when you were taking the flag.
No.
He could have killed you.
Oh, yeah. And then after I took the flag down, I put the flag in my pocket. You got those jumbo pockets, and I put it in my pocket. When I got back on the ship 4 days later, I still had this flag.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got home, I put it in my treasure chest, and my daughter was going through my stuff for 4 or 5 years. Well, it's been about 10 years now. And she found this flag. Said, "What's this flag, Dad?" And I told her. I said, "That's the one we took off a flagpole in Okinawa." And so I folded it up and put it away, and I still got the flag now.
And I imagine there were a few American servicemen, whether they were Navy like you or Army or Marines or even Army Air Corps, that ended up on Okinawa, because that was a long, drawn-out battle over a lot of territory. There are probably quite a few of them that ended up bringing a flag of some kind back. But my guess is yours might be the first one. Could anyone have grabbed the flag on Okinawa before you did?
Any one of the three that took it down. I cut it off because it was tied onto the pole.
Yes, but so there were three of you, but there was only one flag.
Right.
So you got that flag. And I'm just saying timeline-wise, because this is the first day of the battle, and you're in there early on, you were probably the first American to take a Japanese flag on Okinawa.
Right.
What was the significance of that for you, to cut down this Japanese flag, not just to take it for yourself, but to put up in its place the Stars and Stripes?
That was amazing. A lot of memories go by there. I look back at that flag and salute it and say, "Oh, there's my flag.
Mm-hmm.
It's our country."
And there was a long way to go in that battle.
Oh, yes. 10,000 a day were being killed.
And you'd be back on the ship for most of it.
Yeah.
But you did see some. So the first day on Okinawa, you're one of the first in. You take this flag. Still the Japanese are firing on you guys. How long did that day feel?
Seemed like it never ended.
Yeah?
Especially about dusk. When it got dusk, it was about 50 Japanese planes coming over. Those kamikaze pilots. Oh, they just blackened the sky. And here they come, and you just jump in your and dive into your foxhole. And these planes, terrible noise. They couldn't get any planes off because it was just about dusk, and they didn't get any planes off. So all the ships at sea were firing.
So you have a pretty good seat for this show.
Yeah.
The ships are close enough to shore that you can see them.
Oh, yeah.
And you see the kamikazes attacking them. Is that a bit of a helpless feeling? Or do you find yourself cheering?
Nothing you can do.
Yeah.
Just pray that you don't get hit.
Yeah, and pray those guys out on the ships are safe.
Because they've got some of those planes were hitting right near the beach, blowing up.
Mm-hmm. Did you lose any friends that day?
No. Luckily, we were on the beach, and the Army was moving ahead.
Uh-huh.
We had friends that got shot, but that's about it.
Uh-huh.
I got hit one time in my hand, but that's a small shell. You know, a small arm, so...
It was that day, or
reach down, yeah. Reach down, pull it out with your teeth, because it burns. Burns like it's on fire.
Okay. You're saying that like it's not a big deal, but the rest of us, for the most part, have not been in these kind of situations. So you're 18 years old. You're on the beach on the first day of one of the biggest battles in the history of the world, and a bullet hits you?
Yep. You're scared.
So you're trying to direct troops who are still coming into shore?
Yeah, and call for whatever supplies they needed.
Uh-huh. That sounds like a pretty chaotic scene. It's probably just go, go, go.
It is go, go, go. You don't sleep for 3-4 days.
Literally.
You're up all night long calling the radio, and you might nap, but that's about it.
As troops come ashore, they keep moving inland, but you're staying there to keep things moving and coordinate what's happening. But in that job, you're on the radio, and did you know people were shooting at you, or did you just feel it out of nowhere?
You could hear them.
You could hear guns going off.
Yeah, the Japanese are... They'd had the cliff up there. It was mountains. And they had dug in big shoulders up on the cliffs. And they had trails. And they packed the dead bodies. They packed in front as a guard.
Uh-huh.
So they were looking over the dead bodies. And we ended up going up there and with hand grenades and sneaking up there and throwing the hand grenade in the cave that they had built so it would be, wouldn't be any more small arm fire.
But before that, you actually get hit in the hand.
Yeah. We didn't worry about that.
Well,
just a small one.
Well, what did it feel like? How did you realize what had happened?
It just burned like somebody hit you with a hot coals.
And you look down at your hand, and what do you see?
It was right here in the wrist.
Your left wrist.
You just reach in there, and nothing else to grab, and so you bite on it, spit it out, and burn your lips. And you do what you have to.
I'm sorry I'm laughing. I'm picturing this, and again... You're talking about this so mundanely, like this is something that just happens. But you have a bullet that lodges in your wrist, a hot piece of metal.
Yeah.
And you took your teeth and bit in and got it out of there.
Yeah.
You'd never done that before.
Nope. We've been trained, though, for first-line medics because there's no doctors on there.
Uh-huh.
So if somebody gets shot or a shrapnel or whatever, you can do a minor incision and take it out. If they break a bone, you feel with it.
Like uh-huh. And
you find out what's the matter, and then you tape it up. Most of those guys were, I don't care. I'm going to go on. Get me well, and I'm going. My job is to fight. Give me my rifle.
So you'd been trained to render first aid if people were injured around you. But is that how you were trained to do it, to bite a bullet out of somebody?
No, you just do what you have to.
So when it hits you, you go ahead and you clamp down on the bullet and pull it out of there and spit it out naturally. Didn't think about saving it for your kids?
Nope.
You weren't thinking about ever being married or having kids at that point.
Saving your life. Your life is more important. Get it out of there.
So what did it look like after you took the bullet out of there? I imagine there's some blood, right?
Yeah, there was blood. It was sore. You push it back together as much as you can and put a bandage over it.
Uh-huh. You had to do that all by yourself?
Yeah. Put a little sulfaformaldehyde in it and bandage it up.
Well, just the fact that you got hit in the wrist... That's a pretty close call, isn't it?
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I think it's pretty close to the old heart, but it's only a small arms, you know, like a .22 bullet.
Well,
so if it hits a bone, it's going to just smush her. It's not going to be like a big .30-30 rifles that the Army was using.
Well, still, if it's in the right spot.
Oh, yeah.
That could be it for you.
The neck, the head.
Yeah. So you said you were scared before that happened.
And you're scared after.
More scared?
Oh, yeah.
And you have to keep doing your job.
You do your job.
And you said you guys didn't sleep that whole 4 days you were there?
You nap once in a while, but the minute you go to sleep, there's something going on, blowing up someplace.
How did you do that? What do you think happened inside of you to enable you to carry out those duties, to stay awake, to keep fighting, to doing whatever you were doing?
Just the flow of adrenaline.
Yeah?
Just keeps you moving.
I'm imagining you had never experienced anything quite like that before.
Nope. No. I don't want to do it again.
Yeah. So what were those ensuing days like?
Oh, they tapered off a little bit when the Army kept further in, and the airplanes quit flying over.
Uh-huh.
So it got better, got a little easier to take.
Was it more challenging in the dark than it was during the daytime?
No, more challenging in the daytime.
Why?
You had more Amtraks coming ashore. Amtraks coming back with somebody that's been shot, and all they want to do is get that bullet out or get that shrapnel out or whatever it is, and then go on. They don't even want to give you their name and their number. I'd get their name and number and turn it over to their officer so their officer could make sure that they followed up with the medics, that they didn't get any kind of infection or whatever, and got properly treated like in a hospital station. And then they put on their record that they'd gotten shot, you know.
Right. So you're helping people go in to battle in advance, but you've also got them coming back wounded. You're processing them. You got them coming and going.
Yeah.
You're a pretty busy guy.
Well, there's not that many.
Were you helping with first aid for some of them too, or
yes,
only yourself? Okay. So you had to help patch up some other guys.
We had a basic medical training.
Uh-huh.
Where we could do minor incisions and stuff like that. We had a kit there. You had to sharpen your knives and everything. It's not like the knives today are disposable.
Mm-hmm.
You had to sharpen them.
Can you give us an example of some of the things you had to do in caring for those wounded soldiers who came back?
Well, one tank driver had gotten off his tank, and he'd gone ashore kind of looking around to see where he was going to go, and he stepped on a landmine. It blew his heel. The whole heel just opened up in his shoe. The heel part just opened up, and he come back, and he'd got him back on the tank some way, and he came back, and he wanted to see what he could do, so he got off, and we looked at it, and it just peeled off, like your sole on your shoe would just peel off. And I opened it up and took the tongue depressors and scraped it out, whatever's in there, in the blood and stuff. And then I put butterfly bandages. We had to make our own because they didn't have them. We made them out of tape, put that all around it, had to cut his shoe off to start with, and then taped his foot up with an ace bandage. And I said, why don't you just lay down here and we'll get somebody to take you back to the ship. I'm from a farm up in Oregon, he said. I don't need all that kind of stuff. He says, just get me back on my tank. So he climbed back on the tank, and away he went.
Wow.
And I had his name and his number, and I gave that to his officer, and so they checked it later. Then about, almost been 40 years later, I was up in Oregon, in Yahats, Oregon, where they have a big campground-like. My wife's uncle was there, and we went walking to get the mail. And here comes some guy down the road limping, you know, kind of limping, walking away. He's older than I was. He was probably in his 80s by then. Come limping around, he looks at me, and he's about 100 yards away. But he still sees me, and I hear this guy cussing at me. You SOB, you SOB, you're the one SOB. And my uncle says, what's this? Are we going to get involved in something? I said, I don't know who it is. And I got closer, and he says, you're the SOB that fixed my foot. And so I had to go up and meet his wife, and she was crying. You saved my husband's foot. He said, if it hadn't been for you, he'd have lost his foot. Mm-hmm. I said, well, we do what we have to.
How fulfilling was that for you to see him again and understand how much it meant
good
to him?
It tears my eyes.
I believe it. It's bringing a little water to your eyes right now.
Yep.
Yeah, and probably a few people out there listening. So that's an example. Really, you're kind of a jack of all trades there on this beach in Okinawa.
Well, I've been lucky.
Uh-huh.
The good Lord blessed me with abilities to do a lot of things.
We're overdue for our first break, but when we come back, more memories from what was happening 75 years ago this week. A very dangerous week for anyone near Okinawa. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.